Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is John Maggs. I'm a member of the Board of Governors and a reporter with the Journal of Commerce newspaper. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our members of some upcoming speakers here at the club. On Thursday, June 3rd, the Reverend Ben Chavis, Executive Director of the NAACP, will talk about that organization in a changing world. On Wednesday, June 9th, former President Gerald Ford will distribute the Ford Foundation Journalism Prizes for distinguished reporting on the presidency and national defense. And on Friday, June 11th, Amitai Etzioni, George Washington University professor and founder of the Communitarian Movement, will present a speech entitled The Politics of Virtue. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include the president of Planned Parenthood, Pamela Meraldo, undersea explorer Dr. Robert Ballard, former ambassador to Russia Robert Strauss, EPA Administrator Carol Browner, and U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno. Audio and visual tapes of Press Club luncheons are available through the Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. We are very fortunate to have with us today Alejandro Junco de la Vega, newspaper publisher and the president of the Inter-American Press Association. We are truly on the verge of an historic change in relations between the United States and Latin America, and I think Mr. Junco is going to be discussing that in the relation to the NAFTA and possible economic integration with the rest of the hemisphere. Alejandro Junco de la Vega is president of the American Press Association, as I said, which represents media publishers and editors in the Western Hemisphere. He's also publisher of El Norte, the most important daily newspaper in northern Mexico, based in the city of Monterrey. He's president of Infocel, an online financial information service. Last February, the Wall Street Journal reported that it has been in discussions with El Norte about various forms of journalistic publishing and business cooperation. Back in October 1991, the New York Times reported that Mr. Junco was one of the four media people who that year had been awarded the Maria Moores Cabot Prize from Columbia University for the advancement of press freedom and inter-American understanding. A frequent contributor to the Americas column on the op-ed pages of the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Junco is a skeptic, self-described, of the North American Free Trade Agreement, and I think we'd all like to hear him expand on that position today. He's placed his family's newspapers, particularly El Norte, at the forefront of the momentous changes going on in Mexico, and as vigorous advocates of the fundamental changes we're now seeing in Mexican political and economic life. El Norte is not only aggressive, reliable, and independent, but also a paper of high technology and lofty ideas for the future. And I would add, as I was learning today from Mr. Junco, his company is planning to set up a new newspaper in Mexico City, and perhaps he can tell us about this venture as well. Mr. Junco succeeded James McClatchy as president of the Inter-American Press Association, better known in the Western Hemisphere by its Spanish acronym SIP. Both Mr. Junco and Mr. McClatchy, as well as other members of the association, are dedicated to defending free speech in the Americas and to join with other groups fighting against pressures on the freedom of expression. I'd like to say again that audio and video tapes of today's luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. All proceeds of the sale of tapes benefits the National Press Club Library. And without any further ado, Mr. Junco.
Muchas gracias, John. It is always a great opportunity and challenge to speak before such a distinguished audience, particularly during the siesta hours. Only a few hours ago, I was in Berlin attending the 48th World Newspaper Congress, and I was impressed to hear such accounts as how the East German Communist newspaper Neue Zeit was transformed into a quality paper by his editor, Mr. Hartmann. I was witnessing how the Director General of UNESCO, Federico Mayor, was receiving an award for his support of freedom of expression, something that years ago we all doubted would ever happen. At times I felt like pinching myself. Is this really happening? It seemed that only yesterday UNESCO was at the center stage of attacks on freedom of expression. Then on the way to the Berlin airport, I stopped by Checkpoint Charlie, and I was reflecting on the historical significance of this place, time, and event, especially as it relates to liberty and to information. There was a time now past when a totalitarian regime could suppress and control information. Citizens on the other side of Checkpoint Charlie lived in a place called Das Tal der Ahnungslosen, the Valley of the Uninformed. But gradually, the information revolution caught on. It came in the form of smuggled faxes, of video cassettes, of printing presses, of miniature radios, of television, and soon the uninformed had been empowered. Their comprehension of reality allowed them to be organized and to bring down the barriers of ignorance, intolerance, backwardness, and poverty. The information revolution had led to a political revolution. It is not an exaggeration to say that because of the information explosion, there will not be a government or a tyrant anywhere in this world that can safely feel guarded if their power is based on the ignorance of the people. It is not an exaggeration to say that today the single most important factor towards the perfection of the fledgling democracies in our new world is the existence of information in quantity, quality, and timeliness. It is also not an exaggeration to say that the biggest imperfection of the new market systems that are emerging throughout our continent, and that all the vices of the capitalist system, speculation, excessive intermediarism, cornering of marketplaces, can only flourish if and when there is not sufficient information. Perhaps I am biased like yourself because I'm a member of the information industry, but in my world, information precedes progress. Its absence perpetuates underdevelopment. So like most of you, I travel around the world and in my own and view the challenges and the opportunities before us from the perspective of the journalist. So please accept my comments of today as coming from a colleague who is simply sharing his jet-lagged mind in the hopes that this will help you illuminate some of our common interests, one of those being, of course, our profession. My professional life started when I graduated from a U.S. university in 1969. When I first returned to Monterey after graduating from journalism at the University of Texas, it occurred to me that perhaps the only lasting source of professional development would be that we would really educate our journalists and share with them not only the skills and the techniques of our profession, but also a vision of what is our role in the community and in a democracy. At that time, numerous members of our were lawyers, and somehow they felt that they ought to use the newspaper to help them litigate in courts. Others wanted to participate in politics or to influence the political world, or to use their careers through the newspaper as a stepping stone for other duties. Yet another breed of persons came to us that said, "You are one of the few newspapers that really tell things as they are, that have the courage to speak out. So I want to come work for you because I want to exercise my freedom of expression." Well, to those individuals, we told them, yes, by all means, go to the desert of Nuevo León, exercise your freedom of expression all you wish. And after you have satiated this necessity, you come to our education program, because here we're going to teach you that more important than exercising your own freedom of expression will be the fact that we are the depositaries of a far more important right, the right of our readers to be in touch with reality. So our personal preferences for monarchies, dictatorships, central planning, democracy, markets, Protestantism, Catholicism, liberalism, conservatism, whatever, takes second place to information, pure, objective, factual information. And so our students went out of our education program to face the realities of working in the Mexican information industry in 1970. And at that time, it was a very, very hostile environment. You might remember that at that time in Mexico, the populist era had begun. Expropriations of the farmland were taking place daily. Socialist policies were being put into government. Externally, we were on the third worldism kick. And although we could not internally within our own country find a conciliation of interest, we had this foreign policy that almost consisted of not trying to find what was good for Mexico, but what could be evil for our neighbors to the north. If you analyze how Mexico voted during this era in any of the major international organizations, on every issue, we were exactly opposite of what the U.S. stood for. We were very critical. We exercised our right to reflect civil society's criticism of our federal government. And in 1974, only 1 year after taking the publisher's office, I faced a very critical decision. Either we changed our editorial policy, or we would be left without newsprint. You might remember that Mexico, ever since August 21 of 1935, the information industry, in the newspapers in particular, have been dependent from the federal government for the acquisition of our raw material. Now, to put this in Washington terms, you could imagine that if at the height of the Watergate scandal, Mrs. Katharine Graham had been under obligation to buy her newsprint from Richard Nixon, Watergate would have never happened. And so the most important and the strongest government of the world fell just because of that simple ability to reflect on what was happening. So in 1974, entering the ninth month of the year, our newspaper had received only 17% of its allowed quota of newsprint. That same month, a new newspaper was born in Monterrey with unlimited supply. So it did not take bayonets and soldiers in our newsroom to get the message of the federal government across. But we stuck to our guns. We never changed our editorial policy. And one important managerial lesson that I learned is that in a company, you can deprive it of the raw material, you can prohibit its importation of equipment, or make it difficult to access foreign currency. But if you are not successful in changing its value structure, then the minute these raw materials are back, you are back on top. In 1976, there was a change of government, a new government, the regime of López Portillo. We also did not understand this regime. We did not understand how in the economy the government had become not only its director, but its principal actor, and how, convinced of this imaginary bonanza, Mexico was launched into massive external debt and an expensive deficit structure that took the economic apparatus of a country to its knees. Mr. López Portillo had a different way of dealing with independent press. I remember very vividly the times when our journalists were harassed, when the wives of our executives were harassed, when my own children in their school were harassed. There came a time when I had to leave the country. And I can tell you that being in this country as a visitor, or on this pleasant occasion to be speaking before you, is much different than being in exile. In 1982, a new government came to office. And we also did not understand why the Mexican Constitution was modified to make right what had been wrong, the expropriation of the national banking system. We did not understand why the country was divided in three and why there had been created a social sector, a public sector, and a private sector. We were never informed if we were born to a sector, if we could migrate from one to the other, if we needed a passport, or what. And particularly, we also did not understand why the public sector, with the funds of Uncle Sam's treasury, was given certain rights. One of those rights was the so-called right to freedom of expression. Our government said the right to freedom of expression is so sacred that even the public sector ought to have it. So therefore, in August of 1986, the Mexican government launched a chain of national newspapers styled after USA Today with the proceeds of the emergency funds, or the bailout money that was given to Mexico in the years 82, 84, twice in 1986. We also did not understand why in 1985 a decree was passed that I remember very vividly. It said, any company that purchases electronic equipment for the purpose of sending or receiving a signal to a satellite, the moment it becomes operational, it now becomes property of the nation. So with this decree, the federal government effectively took away from private media the tools by which we can conduct modern-day journalism and gave them on a monopoly basis to the national government newspaper, El Nacional. Well, we also did not understand why at that time my 12-year-old son in his school was reading his textbook on social science, page 86, and it had an explanation of how you, the United States, had become a superpower. Now, I don't know what is your personal explanation. Was it because you have a large, well-educated population, or plentiful natural resources, or a stable, democratic political system? I don't know what your explanation is. I can tell you what my children had to read in the obligatory textbooks of the federal government. It said the U.S. became a world power by controlling at cheap pricing the raw materials for Latin America. One thing that must be understood is that, fortunately, Mexico is changing. And I cannot speak for other industries, but I can speak from the perspective of my industry, the information industry. For one thing, the control of newsprint was abandoned in only a couple of years ago. During the regime of President Salinas, this 50-year-old dependency from the government for the acquisition of raw material was finally taken away. I remember very vividly the standing ovation that President Salinas received from the Inter-American Press Association as he made the announcement at our convention in Monterrey. There was also an important decree passed to liberalize the telecommunication industries. We now can use modern-day tools to conduct our business. And perhaps it would have been quite difficult when I was facing the hardship of previous governments to have imagined that one day the government newspaper chain El Nacional would be offered for privatization. But this is all happening, and sometimes I feel like pinching myself to see if it is really true. But for the first time in the last 20 years, we have some form of saneness in government policy. A president that has taken a country's economy with runaway inflation, with huge government deficits, and has built a stable economy, budgetary balance, and is not asking for bailout money from Uncle Sam's treasury. One thing that I also sometimes feel like pinching myself is that not only has this transformation happened in Mexico, but that after 500 years of xenophobia, after having lived a historical difference with the United States that has spanned most of our recent history, that today the U.S. is having second thoughts about becoming closer allies with Mexico in its struggle to modernize. I have not been a proponent of NAFTA. 2 years ago, I wrote an article for the Wall Street Journal in which I questioned the benefit and the wisdom for Mexico to approach such an external trade agreement. And my reasoning was quite simple. Over 70% of the economic assets of our country are not tradable. For all the respect I have for the Washington Post and Mr. Graham, I can assure you that he will not be coming to Monterrey after NAFTA is signed and simply displace us from our market. We are in the non-tradable sector of the economy. We can certainly trade with tomatoes, but what makes tomatoes possible, the market for cultivable land, is not tradable. And on and on. And my reasoning for being opposed to NAFTA was that we needed first to have an internal liberalization policy, one that would free us of many decades of building shackles in the economy and of putting up controls, that the moment the borders are opened up, we'll act as a giant scissor that would probably eliminate any possibility that we would have of development. But things change rapidly in today's world, and now I am finding myself in a curious position of possibly having to back NAFTA. Because if I had concerns of the economic implication for Mexico in past years, as I had, today I am quite concerned of the political implications of not signing such an agreement. It might have been an error, I don't know, but a psychological dependency built up in our economy, and all of a sudden NAFTA became a sun around which the world of our economy revolved. And in the thinking of many of our businessmen and our investors, there seems to be no life after NAFTA, as far as we are concerned. Now, I will challenge that question because I feel that there are many, many opportunities to make Mexico's economy a much more efficient apparatus by internal liberalization and by such wise measures as that which was taken last week by giving our central bank complete autonomy from the federal government. But NAFTA represents an institutionalization of reform, one that psychologically has made many people feel that we could not find life after NAFTA. So we are facing this incoherent situation today, in which governments that backed presidential regimes that saved our economy, that made it difficult for freedom of speech to exist, that made our countries steer apart, were backed by Uncle Sam's treasury with nearly unlimited funds, and that today, a president who's simply asking for free trade, what your foreign policy of decades has stood for, liberty, free markets, and democracy, that now the U.S. is questioning whether this is a suitable proposal. So we live in an incoherent and unexpected present. And as we acknowledge how impossible it was for someone to have predicted the historical outcome of this decade, we attempt to look into the future, and the uncertainty is there. What will our conversation be like in the year 2000? What will we be reminiscing about? Will we be saying, do you remember when the U.S. and Mexico jointly eradicated drug trafficking and production? Do you remember when children's history books were rewritten to reflect our commonalities and not our differences? Were you there when our countries joined efforts to meet the competitive imperative and teamed up in a synergistic relationship? Or will we be saying, do you remember when Mexico's fragile democracy turned to populism, to demagogy, and to upheaval? Were you there when we failed to back with deeds our foreign policy based on liberty, free markets, and democracy as a way of development? Do you remember when we didn't have the 8,000 checkpost Charlies along our southern border? At this historical site yesterday, I read a legend. There are times, people, and events on which and whom only history can pass final judgment. The only thing that remains to be done by the individual is to report on what he saw happening and what he heard. My colleagues, we live in the most wonderful moment of history, one in which we can determine with our reporting of today what will we be reminiscing about as we turn into the third millennium. Thank you.